and other organizers of the conference. And so today I'm going to tell you about work that I've done for quite a long time now. Can everyone hear me if I walk away from this microphone? Okay. So I did my postdocs, first with Chris Doe, who's an ATHMI investigator, and did an extensive lineage analysis of the embryonic central nervous system, and then went to Caltech, where I worked with Kai Zinn, to explore pathfinding of axons and motor axons in particular. And then my father got sick, and I went to go work for Pharmacia, which was later taken over by Pfizer. And so I had some corporate experience as in drug screening, and especially in designing high-throughput drug screens. But I was a dedicated Drosophila neurogeneticist, so I was interested in maintaining that particular research field and continued on with that when I went to academics after Pfizer took Pharmacia over, and as Peter referred to, fired almost everybody that worked for Pharmacia in the CNS genomics unit. So I went to the University of Utah and developed and patented this high-throughput drug screen, and am continuing to work on it now. So I'm going to be telling you essentially how it works, but it's basically still... okay, there we go. It's basically still being worked on, being developed, and hopefully we'll be doing some of the things that Peter referred to in very specific detail. This is going to be actually a little bit more generalized. So what I hope to do today is to just give you an overview of what the point of doing this kind of screening is and how it actually works. So as Peter pointed out, the age-related neurodegeneration is the largest unmet medical need of our time. And one of the statistics that I always find sobering, similar to the ones that he cited, was that the super old in our society are the fastest growing segment of our society, people who are 85 years old and older. And the number of people in that segment of society who will die with Alzheimer's disease is more than 50%. So that actually is quite scary when you realize how much money goes into caring for those people and how much money is being lost in terms of productivity of their children and caretakers. So why are there so many unmet medical needs, things like age-related neurodegeneration? And I think it's because there are three rather disconnected players in this field. The first is Big Pharma, which now consists only of about five or six companies. And the thing that they have to their benefit are huge chemical compound collections, which are extremely well annotated, and they have a huge amount of money for phase three clinical trials, which can actually cost as much as $500 million, not merely $100 million. So they are in a position to be able to do phase three clinical trials in a way that no one else is, and they have largely become phase three clinical trial companies. That is their major job these days. On the other hand, we also have academics who are very smart, hardworking people. And despite the recent emphasis on translational research, they're not particularly profit-driven and are not actually making headway in issues like what is the basic biology of Alzheimer's disease. And I was really encouraged to hear that Peter's going to be spending the next couple of years trying to figure out what is the basic biology of Alzheimer's disease. And I would like to point out that, you know, Big Pharma is not happy with a lot of what academicians do, which is to publish and to make some of the things that they discover then unpatentable. In between these two very extreme ends of doing pharmaceutical research, we have biotech. And biotech people are also very smart. They have to endure strong competition to survive. And they attempt to do drug discovery to phase two clinical trials, which is basically what they can afford to do, and then hope to get bought out by Big Pharma so that they can then turn those drugs into phase three clinical trial targets. So my timeline is actually a little bit less optimistic than Peter's, and it's based on, you know, what we were told at Pharmacia about 10 years ago now. So the current conventional path to drug discovery in Big Pharma is actually quite slow. And cell-based assays are pretty much the way that all drug discovery now occurs in Big Pharma, if it occurs at all. And it takes them about 5 to 10 years to actually come up with a good cell-based assay. Dissimilarity subset screens are done. Candidates are delivered to medicinal chemists who tinker and fix them and make them a little better. They do validation in more cell-based assays, then do first in animal studies, additional animal studies, and so the time you get to clinical trials can vary anywhere from about 11 to 20 years, which is obviously an extremely long and unacceptable period of time. The problem with using cell-based assays is not only that they're slow, it's also that 99.99% of chemical drug candidates fail due to toxicity issues at first in animal stages of study. So if you do something that's in, say, a kidney cell or a fibroblast, and you manage to come up with a hit that's going to work really well in those particular cell-based assays, put them through a bunch of other cell-based assays, once they're in an organism with systems, the probability of that drug actually surviving without killing the animal is going to be very slim. So today what I'm going to be talking to you about is screening compounds directly using imaging paradigms on models of simple, namely single-gene neurodegenerative diseases. So one of the problems that we have that Peter also talked to you about was the fact that many neurodegenerative diseases are complex. When people typically think of complex neural diseases, they think about things like depression or alcoholism or addiction. But in fact, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, things that were classically defined 150 years ago are probably also multi-allelic complex diseases that involve a large number of protein products. So if we could do these kinds of studies initially on simple diseases, single gene diseases, in a whole organism combining both discovery and toxicity, we could actually probably improve the method of drug discovery greatly. So what I'm going to be telling you about is this, what we have to do in order to achieve that goal. So we have to get a reproducible disease model that's based on a single loss of function gene and that's not complex in its phenotype, that can be assayed in an immobile Drosophila embryo. So embryos start moving around in their little egg cases at around stage 16, which is about 16 hours of development. And we want to be able to image them and use high-speed robotic imaging, so we need to be able to have them be sitting still. These embryos have to be able to be treated, and using drug delivery, that's efficiently drugs that are efficiently delivered to embryos, and then successfully treated, and then detected using in vivo fluorescent readout. Okay, so this is basically the thing that we are using to do these drug screens. So this is essentially my artist's rendition of a free-fly embryo. And what you have here, this is actually an unfertilized egg. And what you have is just essentially a big giant cell that's 500 millimeters long, so half a centimeter long, actually half a millimeter long, sorry, 500 microns long, about the grain of the size of a grain of salt. And it's surrounded by two membranes, a vitellin membrane, which is made of chitin, and a waxy chorionic membrane, which is easily removed using simply bleach. The problem that we have then is how are we going to get drugs into these embryos, because that chitinous vitellin membrane is really a formidable barrier and difficult to penetrate. So we do know that we can penetrate them. So this is a fruit fly embryo that's been filleted. So what I do when we do these experiments is to cut the embryo down the middle and then basically spread it open like a book. And so what you see is the midline there, those two green stripes are the midline down the central nervous system. And then you see the motor axons going to the muscle targets. Each hemisegment has 34 motor neurons, and each hemisegment has 30 body wall muscles. The muscles are stained with phylloidin in red, and the motor neurons in the are stained with green, and these are easily stained if the embryo has been opened up and filleted, but we can also get these antibodies into embryos that are intact and whole and fixed, but we have to permeabilize them. And the problem with that is that it's not particularly useful to use those conventional permeabilization methods for drug delivery. So I'm just going to do a brief aside here to tell you a little bit about the reason that I actually am uniquely positioned to be able to do these kinds of studies in the fly. So When I was a postdoc in Chris Doe's lab, they had been working on the transcriptional palettes that define the stem cells that give rise to the invariant lineages in the nervous system. So what you see here is what's called the hyperneuroblast map, which was a name given to the map of the neuroblasts by a graduate student in the Doe lab. And over a period of many years, what they've done is examine the expression pattern of various transcription factors. So each one of those colors represents a transcription factor that comes on at a particular time point. So those are stages 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. There are 5 waves of neurogenesis, and each neuroblast is born at a very specific time and place. It's invariant from hemisegment to hemisegment, embryo to embryo. And each one of those neuroblasts gives rise to an invariant lineage. So now, when the work that I did involved taking a very tiny little needle that has been beveled on a diamond wheel and then poking the space between the vitellin membrane and the embryo and then injecting a 1 micron wide drop of dye, which is then automatically just sucked up by the neuroectodermal cells, the outer layer of these cells. And in 1 out of 6 cases, that neuroectodermal cell is going to form a neuroblast. Those neuroblasts that we just saw in the hyperneuroblast map. So in 1 out of 6 cases, what we see right here, is the dye eye drop being taken up by a neuroectodermal cell. And in 1 out of 6 cases, that neuroectodermal cell will invaginate and become a neuroblast stem cell. So the neuroblast stem cell then goes on through various asymmetric cell divisions. It can be identified at very early stages using in vivo reporter genes like in Grail GFP. And then you can just look at the dye eye labeled cells in a much older embryo and see which cells have been generated from this particular neuroblast. And what we found is that all 34 neuroblasts generate completely invariant lineages that truly are identical from segment to segment, embryo to embryo. So here you see the neuroblast 7-1 lineage. So there's neuroblast 7-1. And what it does is generate the motor neurons that are called the U's. It generates a series of interneurons as well. And you can see that it contributes to the intrasegmental nerve, the longest motor neuron in the fly embryo, and has endings on every single one of those 30 body wall muscles. So what I'm trying to point out here, is the fact that the Drosophila embryo has an invariant lineage, very similar to some of the invariant lineages that we see in C. elegans. The determinism of the embryonic central nervous system is unique in the fly and non-imaginal tissues. So what we're seeing is that we know exactly which cells come from which neuroblasts, where they go, which muscles they innervate, what their targets are if they're not innervating muscles. We know exactly which neurotransmitters they use, which transcription factors they express. We just know a lot about the embryonic central nervous system in the fly. So the question is, can we come up with a reproducible model of a disease that's based on a single loss-of-function gene or gain-of-function gene, for that matter, that's not complex in its phenotype? And the thing that we're going to be looking at is spinal muscular atrophy. Okay. For those of you not familiar with spinal muscular atrophy, it is currently the leading pediatric killer of children. The leading pediatric killer in the United States. So it used to be the case that cystic fibrosis was the most common lethal genetic disease for children in the United States, but now that unique distinction falls to spinal muscular atrophy. Spinal muscular atrophy derives from the loss of a gene called the survival of motor neurons. So this is a case of 2 very unfortunate acronyms that can be confusing. So SMA, spinal muscular atrophy, survival of motor neurons, is the gene that's missing or deleted or altered in spinal muscular atrophy. There are 3 types of this disease. One in approximately 3 to 5,000 live births is a spinal muscular atrophy child. 70% of those children have type 1 spinal muscular atrophy, which is the most severe. It's typically diagnosed prior to age 6 months, and those children die of respiratory failure by age 2, typically. Type 2, which accounts for the next 28% of this cohort, is a little less severe. They're typically diagnosed at an older age, at approximately 18 months, and they die usually at ages 9 through 10, 9 to 10. And then in a very rare small number of patients, there's a type 3 form of the disease where these children can actually survive to adulthood and have gait issues, but are otherwise normal. Now, mutations in SMN are what cause SMA. There are five nucleotides that are altered in the seventh exon splice acceptor site so that the seventh exon is not included in the mutated versions of SMN. Now, humans and bonobos are the only animals that have two versions of the SMN gene. SMN1 is wild type in every instance, but SMN2 is the one that has the five nucleotide change. When there's a deletion of SMN1, the animal or the human has to rely on the SMN2 transcript in order to survive. SMN2 is interesting in that there is some read-through that includes the seventh exon, so 10% of the transcript that's made from SMN2 is actually normal and can actually compensate for the complete loss of SMN, which does occur occasionally, and that would be embryonically lethal. So we can duplicate that in flies. There is an SMN gene in flies, and there is also a hypomorphic allele that's very similar to the case that you'd see in a human patient that has a deletion of SMN1 and then a compensatory SMN2. What we generally have found is that by reducing levels of SMN in the fly, either by RNAi or by genetics, or either so by either genetics or reverse genetics, we're able to show a number of things. First is that we can have a dose-dependent phenotype that's related to how much SMN is actually available. So you see here that when we use 5 micromolar concentrations of double-stranded RNA specific for Drosophila SMN, that we completely wipe out motor neurons that are exiting from the central nervous system. So what you're seeing here is the ventral nerve cord. These are our glial cells along the midline, and here are muscles to the left. These are stained with phalloidin. This is a stain for SMN, and this is an antibody that stains SMN. It's a polyclonal antibody made against human SMN at Toronto Children's Hospital. And what you can see is that in the wild-type embryo, SMN is stained by this human antibody. And when you take that SMN away using reverse genetics, that specific staining pattern goes away. So the very specific staining that's associated with this human antibody works in flies and suggests that there may be at least some structural or functional conservation of the protein. When you increase that concentration of double-stranded RNA to 10 micromolar, you pretty much completely decimate the structure of the central nervous system. What we also found that was really interesting, though, was that as further evidence of the fact that there's no motor neuron being directed to the muscle is the fact that these myopodia, which are little filamentous projections from the surface of the muscle that essentially greet the motor neuron as it arrives at its target to form the synapse, those are exaggerated when SMN has been removed. So that what you have are filopodia that are actually surviving longer and being enlarged, waiting for motor neuronal innervation to occur that never does happen. So genetically, we see exactly the same thing. This is the lethalon-3 AO73 mutation of SMN, and this is just stained with phalloidin. You can see that in the wild type, you see motor axons coming from the central nervous system, and that in the genetic mutant, which is once again just a hypomorph, you see a very diminished, if not altogether absent, exit of motor neurons from the central nervous system. When we did single-cell analysis of embryos that lack SMN, we did that with reverse genetics and injected double-stranded RNA, but RNA in very early embryos, waited a half hour, and then did the lineage analysis that I told you about earlier, and found that what you have is motor neurons that are correctly born in the proper position at the correct time and place, expressing the same pattern of transcription factors. However, they ignore pathfinding cues and sort of turn on themselves, begin to degenerate, and eventually lead to retraction and ultimately motor neuronal death. So it seems to be the case, and is the working hypothesis that we have going in the lab, is that motor axons just are not able to keep up with the rapid extension that's necessary to maintain motor axonal growth. And when you think about it, that's actually important because every cell of the organism, every cell of the human organism and a fruit fly requires SMN. Its function is to make SNRP, small nuclear ribonuclear proteins, and to make the SM complex, which actually forms the spliceosome. So ironically, the defect in SMN2, the splice acceptor site defect, is leading to the inaccurate ability to splice other transcripts. So every single cell does require that spliceosome, but motor neurons specifically are what are dying here. So the question that people in the SMN world have, the SMA world have, is what is it about motor neurons exactly that requires, So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here and just tell you that we understand a great deal now about how SMN works in flies and in motor neuronal extension. So that was the first part of what we had to do in order to develop this as a high-throughput drug screen, was basically come up with a good phenotype that we could use that would be a robust phenotype for screening. The next thing that we had to do was to show that this could be treated in Drosophila embryos, that essentially we could deliver drugs to embryos. And I'll be honest with you, that's the huge stumbling block that people have had in using fruit fly embryos for high-throughput drug screening. So it's because of that vitellin membrane. The vitellin membrane just keeps everything out. It's made of chitin, it's like your fingernails, and it can just not be permeabilized in living embryos without actually destroying the embryo. So skipping ahead, what we basically found was that we could, using conventional methods, using DMSO and soap and various solvents, we could get drugs into embryos, but we couldn't do it with 100% efficacy. And we found that the permeabilizing agents themselves were often causing lethality and death. Then Nature extended its scanned copies of old journals online, and I found this paper that was published in 1960 that revealed that you could isolate chitinases from mushroom extracts so that you could use high salt concentrations and high temperatures to essentially isolate chitinases, which would do exactly the job that we needed them to do, namely punch holes in this vitellin membrane. Furthermore, and this is Noelia Flores de Jesus, Christmas Flowers of Jesus, who did this work and did an excellent, beautiful job in showing that we could get these mushroom extracts to actually permeabilize these embryos, that their central nervous systems developed normally, that they'd hatch, and that they were perfectly fine. But we also had, I also have a friend and colleague in the fly world who's identified a mutant that she's not yet published or patented, so I can't reveal the identity of that mutant to you. But it is an error in the converting enzyme for the final stages of chitin production. So it too produces a vitellin membrane with holes in it. And so we can approach this problem now both chemically and genetically, and have had great success both in showing that the embryos develop normally, central nervous systems are normal, but that we can use very potent drugs like JKL12, which is a gamma secretase inhibitor, a very broad spectrum gamma secretase inhibitor that causes Notch phenotypes, which I just showed you briefly with the Noelia slide, and we can stain those with rhodaminated anti-HRP and get perfect Notch phenotypes that are dose dependent. So we've met this third criterion, and now the fourth one is, can this all be successfully detected with in vivo reporter genes? So I may go over just a couple of minutes if that's okay. Okay, so this is a number of people have basically already done medium throughput screens in flies for drugs. You've probably heard of some of these. Steve Warren at Emory has done a screen for Fragile X mental retardation system, Fragile X mental retardation, and has found several drugs that have been very effective in dealing with that. And Leslie Thompson and L. Lawrence Marsh at UC Irvine have been screening for drugs dealing with Huntington's disease. But these are all screens that involve putting drugs into food, feeding them to flies, and then actually looking at phenotypes by hand, manually, with lots of graduate students and postdocs definitively not high throughput. So what I wanted to do was to be able to find a way that we could detect all of this robotically and meet the requirement for high throughput screening, which is approximately screening 10,000 entities per 40-hour week per full-time employee. So in order to do that, we'd have to generate a relatively complex phenotype. But in the fly world, this is not a complex phenotype. So we've got about 13,000 genes in the genome, and so essentially I'm making a fly here that has four transgenes. So I've got a single-minded RFP fusion protein on the X. I have a driver, this D42 driver. Essentially, I'm just going to cut to the chase here. I'm making motor neurons green, I'm making the ventral midline red, and I'm giving them SMN. Okay? And I've got them balanced over this little Drosophila genetic trick called a GFP labeled balancer. This allows me to keep this fly in the lab and propagating it, making millions and millions and millions of these flies, without them actually dying of SMN. Because obviously, if you have two bad copies of SMN, the fly's going to die. Okay, so if we look at what these things actually are, the single-minded RFP gene is the thing that's generating this red line very, very early in development. I have US membrane GFP and D42 Gal4 generating green motor neurons that are coming out perpendicular to that red line. And then we have SMN making these motor neurons not come out. You saw that with the phylloidin stains that I showed you. We have a mystery gene that I can't tell you about that's perforating the vitellin membrane, the chitinase defect. And we have a GFP balancer that turns on very, very early in development, in the earliest stages of development when actin turns on, so that we can detect which embryos are heterozygous or homozygous for the balancer, but not homozygous for the SMN defect. And then we take millions and millions of these embryos, we put them through an embryo sorter that uses a solid state embryo sorter. It detects the GFP balancer, the actin GFP balancer, and then very accurately using a solid state laser, aliquots only the homozygous SMN embryos into 96 well plates at a number that I designate, maybe 100 or 200 per well. The rest are discarded as being useless because they don't have the homozygous SMN phenotype. These embryos now have to go through imaging, robotic imaging. And this is the instrument, I'm going to show you the instrument that's actually able to do this, but there are now a number of them on the market. These are automated robotic imagers, confocal imagers. What happens is that this confocal will take a picture of a quarter of the field of view of a well in a 96 well plate, and it will look for red. It will look for the red line. And then it can also detect the outside outline of the embryo. If that distance A that I've underlined over there from the red line to the outside of the embryo is not equal to the distance B, that embryo is not considered in the evaluation. Because that means that the embryo has been tilted and we can't get an accurate reflection of how long its motor axons are. So we're looking at red first, then rapidly switch to green, look at only the extent of the length of the motor axons that are being protruded from the middle of the embryo at a perpendicular angle to that red line, and then use a seed fill algorithm. And I'm not going to explain to you how those work. They're really very straightforward, commonly used, used all the time in all kinds of imaging software, and count how many pixels are contiguous in these sick embryos. If the drug that we've supplied these embryos and that they've been sitting in for 36 hours between the time we aliquoted them and now the time that we're imaging them, if that drug has worked, we would expect to see that that number of pixels will be longer, will be larger. One of the cool little tricks about this particular robotic reader is that you do have the problem of, what if you have your embryos and they just all happen to fall at a weird angle and you're not getting any good readouts? Are you getting something that's basically not effective, or are you getting just bad luck in having your embryos not be well positioned? And so the actual robotic imager has a little nudging trick where it lets the embryo plates be nudged, settle down, nudge, settle down, and you can repeat the imaging three times per well, per plate. The entire plate can be read as a confocal Z-stack with 20 images in 10 to 15 minutes. So that actually allows us to meet the high throughput requirement of 10,000 embryos, 10,000 wells per week per FTE. 10,000 compounds per week per FTE. This is the imager that we used at Utah, and it's really excellent. It had an open source code, which is now no longer available, so I have to get actually quite a different one. We've done proof of concept studies that show that HDAC inhibitors actually do work to extend motor axons, but to a very minor extent. And JKL12, that Notch inhibitor, actually can be detected as being a toxic compound, so it does kill the embryos, and that's quite obvious when we compare that to essentially inert compounds. So we're going to be doing this obviously now in much larger compound collections. And just to finish up, I'm just going to tell you this obviously has other applications as well for biologicals as well as chemical compounds. So you can supply small inhibitory RNAs, you can supply monoclonal antibodies, but the limiting factors there are not the screening. Limiting factors there are actually generating the biologicals. So I just want to finish up by thanking all the people that I've worked with and all the people who are involved in the legal activities as far as like patenting and IP issues, and also Dr. David Budell and Mark Nettleman for inviting me today. And so this is basically how we're doing high throughput drug screening in fruit fly embryos. And I can take any questions. Yes, we can. So one of the things that we can do is just simply look at the level of fluorescence that comes out of a well, so green fluorescence or red fluorescence. So if for example, you have a CNS defect that's affecting motor neuron development or any kind of development, you're either going to see way less GFP or you're going to see an overgrowth, because if you have something very early like a Notch phenotype, a neurogenic phenotype, you're going to be seeing a loss of ectodermal-derived tissues and an increase in neurally-derived tissues. So you can actually look for differences in fluorescence. Yes?
So in a situation like this, when you get a whole embryo phenotype, and if you don't know compound, you won't know what the target is, right? So have you thought about what that test might be?
Yeah, there are all kinds of secondary screens that we've already had in mind. And so secondary screens can be huge. So one of the things that we'd obviously... One of the things that we've had to do here first is figure out how to separate autofluorescence in the gut from GFP, and so we've been able to do that with very specific filters. But we can also use that to our advantage in that you can look at gut phenotypes as well as a secondary screen using a different GFP filter. You can also use size, you can use the phenotypes that have been described in flies are just enormous. So you can look at a number of different defects. But that basically gets at the question of what's going wrong, and can you tell what's going wrong? And that might be something that's interesting in terms of a specific drug, but what we're going to be doing is eliminating the drug that's making something go wrong. So the secondary screens that we're basically interested in looking at are the ones that are going to be looking at other issues of toxicity, and so we'd have to define other assays that are not CNS-based to see whether or not there are other issues of toxicity that seem to still allow normal development and hatching.
Okay, we'll take questions at the break.
Okay.
Find Alice out. You put your computer down.
Oh, I did. Thank you. Okay.
Our next speaker is James Monahan. James is an assistant professor here at Northeastern University. I think you've been here about a little over a year, right, James?
Yes, sir.
And he is his research focuses around limb regeneration and stem cells. And James.
Okay. Looks like it's working all right. So, like Mike said, I am James Monahan. I've been here barely over a year, so I moved to Boston.